on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
You are not alone. Strike Debt Portland, in solidarity with the National Strike Debt Movement, will hold a debtors' assembly at 6805 North Macroom Street in St. John's on Saturday, March 12th, 3:30 to 5:30. Again, this Strike Debt Assembly is on Saturday, March 12th at 3:30 at 6805 North Macroom Street in St. John's, just off Willamette Boulevard. For more information, go to 350pdx.org.
This is 90.7 FM in Portland, 91.9 FM Hood River and the Gorge, 104.3 FM Philomath and Corvallis, K220 HR Hood River, K282 BH Philomath.
And you are listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next, the Digital Divide. If you enjoy what you hear on this station, help support KBOO Community Radio by donating your car, truck, motorcycle, ATV, motorhome, trailer, boat, helicopter, submarine, or any other type of vehicle. We'll transform your car into resources for unserved and underserved communities, free training, recording, equipment, and great programming for all of KBOO listeners. For more information, you can call our toll-free number at 877-KBOO-123. That's 877-526-6123. Or go to our KBOO website, kboo.fm/vehicle. Now, the Digital Divide. I'm Rabia Yeaman with The Digital Divide, and today we are going to be talking cannabis. But we're going to be talking about cannabis testing in Oregon, and we're going to be talking to a former cannabis lab worker who has a master's in organic chemistry, and we're just going to be talking about the ins and outs of cannabis testing. Welcome to The Digital Divide.
Oh, thanks very much.
The way I understand it, medical cannabis in Oregon is managed under the Oregon Health Authority, and recreational cannabis is managed by the OLCC, kind of like alcohol. Is that right?
Yep, that's correct.
Right. That seems a little weird to have two different agencies, but I get it. You know, one is for, you have medical patients So it's under the Oregon Health Authority. And the recreational is just like alcohol, so that's OLCC. But kind of weird that two agencies, that seems more expensive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's just the way the laws were written. Measure 91 specifically names OLCC as the governing body of the recreational marijuana program. So that's what they have. But, you know, while we were passing the law, there was a lot of discussion there on which one would be best. And I think it's yet to be seen which one is actually better.
There's a possibility in the future that the way the programs are managed could evolve or change.
Definitely. I believe anything about the current laws can change.
Okay.
Yeah.
You're very familiar with the laws because you worked in a lab.
I'm not an expert, but I think I know enough. I know a lot.
Let's just kind of start at the beginning. What do cannabis labs test for?
Sure. The main things that they test for are potency, as far as THC goes, and then also they're required to test for CBD. But we should actually step back because there's something called compliance testing, which is the minimum testing necessary to have cannabis on the shelf at a dispensary.
Now, are we talking about, can we not have to distinguish? Can we say that everything that we're going to talk about applies to both medical and recreational cannabis?
Right, because at this point, all of the cannabis at dispensaries is medical. So it's all the same
okay.
at this point. Yeah. And the minimum standard for having cannabis on the shelf is that it has to be tested for potency for two different cannabinoids. That's THC and CBD. Two out of, you know, a million different cannabinoids. And then also they have to be certified as being free of molds and pesticides.
Just to be sure I'm understanding, all cannabis that's sold commercially in Oregon must be tested, and they all must be tested for these same things.
Right.
So every lab, they have to do at a minimum testing for those things.
Right.
Okay.
And then, I'm not sure that every lab does all of that testing because some labs are contracting it out at this point to different labs. So, but in order to be certified to sell your cannabis, you have to have this report that has these specific tests on it.
Okay.
And then there's a lot of other elective testing that you can do. Like you can see what other cannabinoids are available. Like CBG is really important right now. Or
tell us about CBG.
It's cannabigerol. CBG is the cannabinoid that's sort of the first product that a cannabis plant produces. So CBG is the root molecule and then decomposes or is converted into all of the other cannabinoids like CBN or THC or CBD. They all come from CBG.
Okay. We're learning things, knowing more.
It's complicated to describe. It would really require a visual to show you exactly what happens.
Okay, well, maybe we'll be able to post some visuals on the website.
Okay, sure.
KBOO.FM. Now, what pesticides are they? Are there specific types of pesticides that, because that would be like a major concern that I would have is I don't want to be inhaling. I don't want to be vaporizing and inhaling pesticides.
Mm-hmm.
That seems counter to ingesting cannabis, right? We don't want to eat pesticides, and we definitely don't want to smoke pesticides. So are they required to test for specific types?
Yeah, there are four main classes of pesticides that are required testing for cannabis sold on the shelves. However, because there isn't a specific list of pesticides, the pesticides that labs are actually testing for vary wildly.
Well, so for an example, do they have to test for pyrethrins? Like yeah. all of them, do they, regardless of the brand or anything like that, are pyrethions? Because it's very commonly used pesticide for a variety of insects.
Right. So the four classes are pyrethroids, carbamates, chlorinated hydrocarbons, and then organophosphates. And within those classes, there are hundreds of different pesticides.
Right.
And pesticide testing itself is very expensive. So a really big issue that we're seeing in labs right now. So carbamates, organophosphates, pyrethrins, and chlorinated hydrocarbons. And there are hundreds of different pesticides within those classes. And because pesticide testing is very expensive, a lot of labs currently will do the minimum amount of testing.
For the maximum price.
For the maximum price. And because labs aren't regulated at all, there's nobody looking over their shoulder to see what they're actually doing. And because a lot of people in the industry have never worked in a lab before, it's really tricky. A lot of these labs are fudging results and producing reports that I would call fraudulent, certifying that they're doing testing that they're not doing at all.
Okay, so that's my greatest fear. So, you know, when you go into a dispensary and if you buy cannabis, then it's going to have a label on the package that you get that we assume comes from the testing.
Right.
But if that's fraudulent, then where does that leave us? And tell us how they fudge. We want to know. How do they fake it? I mean, do they just literally make things up and put it on a label?
I mean, anyone can print a report.
Right.
Especially if there's no list of acceptable equipment that you have to use or, you know, there's no minimum standard, you can write anything on a report or a label. And that's something that's been really scary about the industry, because if you actually are doing the pesticide testing and actually looking at numbers, you see that a lot of cannabis is just filled with pesticides.
Because you're laughing when you say that, but that is not funny. That's not funny. You're laughing because of the irony.
Yeah, I'm laughing.
It's because it's ironic.
Yeah, it is. It is.
Not all dispensaries carry or sell organic, but some say that they do. Now, if a dispensary says that, you know, some of the strains that they have are organic, should we not trust that also?
I would say that unless you have really in-depth knowledge about their growing practices,
you just don't know.
You just really don't know.
Wow. So really, ultimately, I mean, a lot of people are not going to just start growing themselves, but growing yourself growing your own cannabis is, I guess, the only way right now to be 100% certain of the purity of what you have.
Yeah. Growing your own or just knowing your grower really well is another way.
That's hard to do with the dispensaries.
Yeah.
You know, because they can really say anything. And it doesn't seem a way for the consumer to be able to follow up with the lab to know. I mean, you can't know. I'm not a chemist. So right now, what we understand is that there are laws that say all cannabis must be tested in a lab, but there, and I read this on the state website, that there are no regulations, requirements, or specifications that labs have to follow. It just says they have to test for these things, and it doesn't say how, right? And there doesn't seem to be any oversight. So in terms of people coming and checking and to see if, you know, what's on the label is true.
That's right.
So what do we do? How does it work?
Well, as soon as April and as late as October, labs are going to have new regulations. So they're going to be certified by a governing agency and inspected regularly. And that's something new, and it's really exciting And it should be really exciting for consumers because moving forward, you may be able to just look at a label on a package, see the lab that's testing, see if they're certified. Mm-hmm. And then at that point, you know that the cannabis you're consuming is safe and that the results on the package are accurate.
Because what will happen then, what you're saying, is that the state will come in and they'll actually analyze the lab's results also.
Yeah.
And they'll see if their results match what's on the lab's label.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, well, that's more comforting. You know, if they can, I suppose that's going to eliminate a lot of labs. Like right now, there's kind of a boatload of testing labs in Oregon. And it seems like that sort of oversight will probably thin out some of the cheaters.
Yeah, it's going to thin out the quote-unquote cheaters. And it's also going to thin out a lot of growers and a lot of producers. So we're going to see...
Oh, okay.
I think we're going to see complete turnover in the industry.
When growers have to either change the habits that they've been doing, in other words, they've been using pesticides to, you know, keep the critters away and keep the mold out, and then selling it.
Right.
Right. And then if they can't change their process, then they'll be out of it.
Right. Another aspect of this is the reason why there's so much pesticides and weed, and we've done a loose estimate saying somewhere around 80% of growers grow with pesticides.
Wow.
But the reason is because growing cannabis organically is actually a very, very challenging thing.
It is.
Especially if you're growing indoors.
Right.
Because they're just all of these, you know.
Mites.
Mites and
more mites.
Yeah, a lot of different types of mites and fungus that right. attack indoor cannabis right. plants. So,
you're right, where outdoor plants don't quite have those same issues because they're mm-hmm. in a natural environment.
Right. It's another reason to buy outdoor. I know that there's a lot of poo-pooing of outdoor cannabis, but it's probably some of the safest and best weed that you'll find on the shelf. Because when cannabis is grown outside, it's able to pick up natural light and natural nutrients from the soil, which can really affect flavor and potency.
Right. It makes a lot of sense. So growers are less likely to use pesticides for outdoor growing.
I think it's just easier to grow outdoor without pesticides.
Right. And I mean, if you're a grower, it's not like you want to have the extra expense of pesticides. You only do it because you feel like you need to either prevent a problem or solve a problem. But if you don't have that problem, you're not going to, you know, incur that extra expense in your growing operation.
Sure.
Logically.
Sure.
Logic doesn't always play a part. I get that. But one of the things that we were talking about was, you know, like where we are now, and that kind of sounds like mm-hmm. we have a lot of labs, they're unregulated. And that, in fact, it's possible, we can't know, but it's possible that the majority of the cannabis for sale right now, even if it's called organic, if you don't know, you know, the grower and the process, you honestly don't know. And it could be true or it could not be true.
Right.
And I don't think anybody really wants to knowingly, you know, ingest pesticides. You know, once they go in, they might not come out. In April, are we going to see some changes go into effect that are permanent changes in the law?
Yeah. So starting in April, people can start getting licenses to grow recreational cannabis. And it's going to be harder for people with grower cards, grower medical cards, to grow cannabis in their homes if they're not patients.
And why? Tell me about that. Why is that?
Ooh.
Why is it going to be harder for? So if I wanted to grow recreationally in my home,
mm-hmm. You can have four plants.
Oh, okay. So anybody can have four plants.
I think that's still
There's
accurate.
No way I could fit four plants. That would be like a jungle. You know, I was thinking about that. The recreational program in some ways is going to really put a damper on the medical program. You know, like getting a card is very expensive unless you're on subsidies. If you're not on any kind of subsidy, then getting a card, last time I checked, which has actually been a couple of years, $400. And then you have to find a grower who may or may not charge you. What's the difference between a medical grower and a recreational grower come April?
Starting in April, a recreational grower will have to have some sort of license and grow at a registered grow site. And also starting in April, in order to be a medical grower, you also have to have a patient card and have the same addresses on your grower card and your patient card.
Oh, really? So up until now, the patient had their address and the grower had their address. They were not necessarily the same.
Yeah, this is actually a pretty important point. So before, the way things worked, you could get a medical card as a patient, and then you could list someone on your account as being your grower,
right,
the person that grew for you. And your grower was allowed to have up to 6 plants on their property for your patient card.
Right. And frequently, I mean, being familiar with that, frequently what would happen is your grower would, you know, maybe give you an ounce a month.
Yeah.
Sell the rest. Right, the excess, which there'd be a lot, and so essentially, you know, their patient was kind of giving them the ability to grow, air quotes, legally, and then illegally sell the rest. So this program kind of eliminates the need for medical growers. I mean, if the cannabis is available and anybody can buy it, then the medical program seems like why even still? Well, for juveniles, that's why you have to have it. For juveniles who can't legally use marijuana if you're under 18.
Mm-hmm.
So the medical program gives juveniles who need cannabis for whatever medical reason the ability to. So they'll still have the medical program for juveniles.
Mm-hmm. It also gives you access to things like concentrates, edibles,
topicals. Those will all be available recreationally here. Look at my watch.
You think so?
Of course I think so. Because that's silly.
Mm-hmm.
That's silly to make them not available recreationally. You can't really know. I mean, why wouldn't they be? Because you don't know what the dose is?
Mm-hmm.
And you somehow do know what the dose is on smokables?
It's still in contention, though. I mean, one reason why I've maintained my patient card is because I still like to use concentrates, and I can't access those unless I have a patient card.
Well, there's no doubt concentrates and edibles do, in my opinion, I guess I'll just say my opinion, but I'm willing to make a statement about they're just more effective in pain relief and probably a lot of other medical conditions than smoking it. Mm-hmm. I mean, smoking doesn't really do much for pain relief, in my opinion, but tinctures and edibles seem to be really effective.
Right. Because in order to, you know, make a difference, it has to be a pretty big dose usually.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, big enough dose to where you're probably asleep.
Right.
Right.
Some people develop.
So you're like, it's working. I'm asleep. I don't feel a thing.
So do you know what RSO is?
I do not know what RSO is.
It stands for Rick Simpson Oil. And to me, people's tolerance when it comes to RSO is the measure of how tolerant they are to cannabis. It's usually about 60% THC. Which is low compared with, say, a shatter or something like that. But considering it's all decarboxylated and accessible THC. It's actually pretty strong stuff. And if you are a medical patient and you really need the cannabis and you use a lot of it, people down grams or 2 grams, sometimes more a day. Whereas for other people who are just recreational users, the initial dose that is recommended is to just do like a grain of rice sized, very small, like speck of this RSO. So
you used another word I've never heard called shatter.
Oh, shatter.
I do not know what that means. And I'm going to guess that the majority of our audience doesn't know what that means.
Shatter is the type of concentrate. So generally, it's extracted from cannabis material using butane. And the end result is a very clear, usually amber-colored concentrated.
People call that honey. Or dabs? People call that dabs?
Yeah, dabs is a general term for any sort of cannabis concentrate. Okay, but shatter is a very specific form of concentrate because it breaks apart. And a lot of other concentrates are more waxy or liquid. So that's what distinguishes shatter. And it has to do with the way that it's processed.
Okay, we're learning all about the mysterious world of commercial cannabis and its byproducts. Okay, so you maintain your card so that you can get a more potent. And I did read on I remember somewhere on the internet that medical cannabis products like tinctures are higher potency than recreational products are allowed to be.
I know that in Colorado right now, the maximum dosage for, say, an edible is 5 milligrams per serving. Whereas here in dispensaries for medical products, a lot of the edibles label themselves to be between 100 milligrams and 500 milligrams per serving.
How do they know?
Well, it all depends on the testing. It all comes back to the testing. And that's actually a very interesting topic is testing edibles for potency.
Can we talk a little bit about it?
Yeah, because that's an important science as well. Basically, it is extremely difficult for the average chemist to extract cannabinoids from edible products. You need very specialized methods. And you need to know that the methods you're using are analogous to the ones that other labs are using. Like everybody needs to be using the same method for determining potency in edibles.
Right. Because and that's not happening right now with any cannabis.
Right.
Right. Okay.
Right. With any cannabis, but specifically edibles, because I'm sure that you know you can eat something that is just way too strong and have a horrible reaction to it. Like, there's a serious safety concern when it comes to potency in edibles and knowing exactly how strong things are.
I've heard that. You know, you can have one cookie, it's completely innocent. You can eat somebody else's cookie, same size, same shape, and you can be in a chair for 5 hours.
Yeah.
Which I refer to as being chaired.
So it's very difficult. You need specialized methods to test edibles. And a lot of labs are just not equipped to do it and don't have chemists that are experienced enough to do it.
But yet there's a label that makes a claim.
Mm-hmm. When I worked at a lab, it was actually a really big issue because we weren't regulated and there's no accepted QC that labs are expected to do. Basically, we would issue a result and the clients would come back to us expecting higher results, and they would complain. So there's just a great deal of pressure on the chemists to produce higher and higher potency results on all products, including edibles.
Regardless of whether they're accurate, true, or even meaningful.
Right.
It's like, we just want that higher number, and we're willing to pay you $200 to get it.
Right.
Kind of.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
They're willing to pay, or because there's so much competition in the testing industry, just because they're not regulated and anyone can open a lab, clients would, start at one lab, and then if they didn't get the result that they wanted from that lab, they would just go to the next lab. So, you know, sometimes they would offer to pay more, but often they would just promise their loyalty to you if you gave them the result that they wanted. And that's changing with the new rules, and I'm so excited about that. So going forward, if you want your cannabis to be retested after the labs issue a result, basically you have to submit 3 times the acceptable sample amount. So, for example, if you are submitting 3 grams, you have to submit 12 grams, which is a lot. You're losing product, essentially. You're right. Losing money when you submit extra cannabis like that. And basically, if you're unhappy with the lab results, instead of going back to the chemist, demanding a retest, what happens in April with accredited labs is they send the extra sample out to 3 other labs.
Okay.
And that's how the, you know, retest is determined. And then depending on what the other labs test, that's just the final answer. There's no going back.
It kind of makes sense. Why not just send it to 3 labs to begin with? So in April, we'll have accredited labs, certified lab.
Yeah, starting in April, labs can apply to be fully accredited for their methods.
Are you familiar with what criteria the state will use to determine if someone deserves accreditation?
Yeah, it's going to be very, very strict. Oregon's going to have the most strict rules in the country, actually, and the only certification rules for cannabis labs. So because we're the first, you know, we're going for the best.
Well, good. I like it when Oregon, you know, is a leader in any industry, mm-hmm. especially in this one.
Yeah. Boom, boom, boom,
boom, boom, boom. You know that
music so much better when you're high, high, high. Music so much better when you're high.
Something strange and queer happens in your inner ear. That's good.
Music so much better when you're high.
One puff of this stuff and you throw away your snuff. Once you start, you can't get enough.
High frequencies appear that only dogs can hear. That's good.
Music so much better when you're high.
Music so much better when you're high. Music so much better when you're high.
Something strange and queer happens in your inner ear. That's good.
Music so much better when you're high.
We have known it all along. We will show you we're not wrong. If you don't believe our song,
bum, 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 bum.
Music so much better when you're high, high, high. Music so much better when you're high,
high.
Something strange and queer happens in your inner ear. That's good.
Music so much
better.
Music so much
better. Music so much better.
I'm Rabia Yeaman with the Digital Divide, and we are talking with a former cannabis lab technician, an individual who has a master's degree in chemistry. And we are talking about laboratory testing of cannabis, potency, strengths, everything you want to know, or almost everything you want to know about cannabis, starting in April, and the accreditation program for the labs, Oregon's criteria will be the strictest in the country.
Right. So actually what we're seeing is a lot of labs from outside of the state applying to Oregon accreditation because we're the only ones and the best ones so far.
So out-of-state labs will be able to be accredited by Oregon but still test in their own state?
Yeah, that's the idea.
Wow. And that's because their own state doesn't have any kind of criteria or certification program. Well, that's interesting. It's like a new it is a new industry.
It's a completely new industry.
It's exciting. New industries are exciting. Where do you see testing going forward? How do you think it's going to look, say, in a year, 2 years, or 5 years from now?
I think the industry is going to be a lot different because the cost of producing cannabis due to these regulations is going to increase and it's going to require more capital. We're going to see more large companies rather than small growers.
Oh, no. Oh, it was a tour. People were touring, not in Oregon, but in some other states, of these mega growing operations, and they're going around buying up smaller growers, buying them out with the hopes of really kind of becoming a monopoly,
mm-hmm.
where you have maybe 10 mega growing operations in the United States, and they can price fix then. They mm-hmm. can get together amongst themselves and just agree that these are the prices that we'll charge, and they won't undercut each other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
It's a horrible thought. So you think that's where it's going?
Yeah, I think the legal recreational marijuana industry is going to turn into bigger business. That's one change that will result from these rules. The other thing is, I think that the initial testing standards that we have are a little overkill. Specifically when it comes to things like testing for salmonella, there's no salmonella on cannabis.
No salmonella on cannabis?
No, there's not.
How could there be? Would you have to put a hamburger on it? Then it would be at risk? Or
I suppose there could be, but even if there is salmonella on a product that you're smoking,
right?
I'm not sure if that's truly dangerous. I mean, I understand why you'd want to do strict bacterial testing on something that you're eating. Mm-hmm. But, people have been smoking this product for hundreds of years.
But if you are using it for edibles, is that the rationale?
Yeah, you might want to do it for edibles. You might want to do it. But for just simply smoking, I think the standards are a little strict when it comes to flower.
Okay.
Specifically. So my hope is over time that those strict rules will be relaxed or eliminated, because they simply just add cost to the testing process.
And do you think that maybe they'll test for other things that they just haven't added in the future?
It could be. Yeah. I think that going forward, having a really complete cannabinoid profile will be precious. People know the benefits of THC. They like THC, but there are just so many other cannabinoids that are valuable. It's a healing herb.
Can you tell us about some of the other cannabinoids? Did
sure.
I say that right?
Yeah, I think you did. It's cannabinoids.
Cannabinoid.
Those are the molecules that are produced by the cannabis plant, that some of which are related to THC and some are not.
Okay.
For example, THCV is one that people are somewhat excited about. It's considered to be the quote-unquote speedy cannabinoid.
Okay.
It stimulates, it's an appetite suppressant.
Oh.
Yeah, and a stimulant. So people are excited about THCV because it has sort of the opposite effect as, you know, regular THC.
It makes you want to be snacky.
Yeah.
So THCV makes you unsnacky.
Yeah.
Okay.
THCV makes you want to go out and do stuff.
Okay. Or clean your house. Right. Put on some Grateful Dead. Mop the floor.
Right.
I'm being cliche. That's.
But then the fear is that cannabis that's too high in THCV can lead to more of that anxious feeling that right. you get sometimes when you smoke weed.
Right, so. Right. Anxious, paranoid. Some reasons why some people don't like it.
Right.
Don't like cannabis. And that's interesting that THCV and regular THC are present in the same plant, making you sleepy and active at the same time. Making you hungry and not hungry at the same time. Mm-hmm. But it would depend on the strain.
Right. It depends on the strain.
Okay. So tell us about some other cannabinoids.
Well, CBD is probably the most important one.
That's some people we've really heard about in being able to suppress seizures.
Yeah.
And having like the doctor on CNN, you know, like high profile doctors. Absolutely testifying that it works, it's good, and people who have certain maladies, especially if they related to seizures, should absolutely have it, I mean, have access to it.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. That's one that you would currently see on a label. That's one that we're required to test for currently.
So, right.
Yeah. So that one's really important. And then in addition to all of these different, you know, CBG, THC, CBD, THCV, CBN is another one. There are acid forms of each one. So there's a THCA and a THC. And basically, THCA is the initial product that's produced by the cannabis plant, and it's not psychoactive. It's anti-inflammatory and it has other medical benefits, but it's not psychoactive. And then the thing that actually makes you high is when you rip off a carbon dioxide molecule from your THCA, it becomes THC, and then you get high, and you rip it off by smoking.
So all cannabis has THCA, but when yes. you heat it, the A goes away, leaving just the THC, and then you have those more psychoactive properties.
Right.
So that's fascinating. And so if you were just to eat, and this is a horrible, horrible thought, if you were to say to eat cannabis, just eat it.
Yeah.
Which sounds like a horrible flossing nightmare, but you wouldn't get high because it wouldn't have been heated and it would be the THCA.
Right. Actually, I've heard when I've spent time in Arcata, California with some growers that you can put, you know, a raw cannabis bud on a cookie and that's called a Humboldt County cookie. But yeah, that doesn't get you high.
Doesn't even make sense.
Yeah.
Except for the cookie part.
That? Yeah.
It's so fascinating. Well, one thing that's exciting is I'm sure you're familiar with the MAPS organization. So MAPS is an amazing organization that kind of comes out of Canada, but they're directly responsible in many ways for the clinical trials that are going on right now. We have clinical trials at Johns Hopkins and other teaching universities in the U.S. and all over the world with psilocybin.
Mm-hmm.
And these are tests and trials that are done in a clinical lab with therapists or psychotherapists, doctors and physicians. And these are all FDA approved tests and trials. And we've had MAPS on the program twice as a guest with ecstasy, which are having phenomenal results with people who have formerly untreatable PTSD relieving their PTSD. Not everybody, but like a huge 80% of the people engaged in the trials are having either significant reductions or complete cures. They're just saying they're cured of their PTSD that they may have been walking around for 10, 20, 30 years. So that's pretty phenomenal. And the last drug to be approved for clinical trials by the FDA in the United States, most recently, marijuana. And so now they're doing a lot of trials with marijuana for anxiety, stress, depression, and PTSD, you know, in that kind of clinical therapeutic environment. Mm. So this is really exciting. This is real. A lot of people, they also do trials with LSD in this country and mostly out of the country. And typically that's happening with people who are facing end of life issues. And they're finding that for a vast majority of the people who engage in those trials, of course, those are all you have to be facing the end of your life, your terminal, that people are having like tremendous relief from the anxiety and fear of death.
Wow.
Right. So these things are happening right now with these various drugs, and cannabis, of course, the most recent to come on board, the most dangerous, the most feared of all drugs. No, I'm joking. but, you know, you would think because it was denied approval by the FDA for these trials for so many years and then finally just approved. It would almost be laughable to continue to not approve it when you've approved all these other, what are they, class one?
But it's a treat to just see the culture change and the rules change. It's going to be amazing to see, you know, what happens in our lifetimes as far as compounds go. That, you know, they're illegal, but people still want to take them. I think there is some inherent medical benefits to all of the different drugs that you listed, including ecstasy, cannabis, LSD. But
well, I don't know. Just ask Johns Hopkins, see if they know. We did have a guest on the show, was it month before last, like January, who was one of the co-founders of the psilocybin program at Johns Hopkins. So it was really exciting. Wow. And fun to talk to him, as he was kind of in on the psychedelic movement from the very, very beginning. And now, you know, they're conducting all of these very, very successful trials, and they're expanding. Their most recent trials are with a clergy. So you don't have to be ill to take this trial, to be in this trial. And what they're doing is giving people who are not just in the Christian faith, but religious leaders, giving them psilocybin in a clinical environment with the express purpose of seeing if it will make them more empathetic and able to serve their congregations better. So this is amazing, you know, really getting them in touch with their own congregations and making them more effective, because a lot of times they do act as, you know, kind of in a therapeutic way to their clergy. So these are trials that are FDA approved and happening.
Wow.
Yeah. So there are exciting things happening in our time.
Wow.
Drugs are being destigmatized and really being acknowledged that they have benefits. You know, one of the things I want to talk about is smoking marijuana.
Okay.
And to ask, you know, does smoking marijuana, in your opinion, I know you're not a doctor, you're a chemist, pose, you know, some of the same health risks as smoking cigarettes? Because, you know, if you've ever cleaned out a pipe or a bong, that is a sticky, gooey, messy affair. And to imagine that, you know, that's going on inside you is pretty, it's an unsavory thought.
Mm-hmm. I don't really know the answer to that. I can only speak from personal experience when it comes to smoking cigarettes versus smoking cannabis in excess. and my own fitness level. One important distinction is when you smoke cigarettes, often you don't just smoke one a day. You're smoking...
Very rarely. If you're a cigarette smoker,
most people...
You could run through a pack or half a pack, right?
Or up to two packs even
per day.
So you're just exposing yourself to so much more combustible.
As opposed to a couple
product.
Hits off of a pipe or...
Which is what most people are
or
doing.
Or vaping. Vaping seems much healthier. But I still question if you're heating metal... Right. If metal is being heated up to vaporize, are you, you know, what's the safety factor there in terms of inhaling?
The jury's still out on vaporizing, and it definitely depends on your vaporizer. Right.
Okay.
Like what are you using and what is it that you're actually vaping? Are you vaping some mysterious liquid that has all kinds of solvents in it already?
Right.
Or are you vaping a clean cannabis product?
You know, it seems like we really are kind of at the beginning, like we said, the beginning of a new industry. We're at the end of prohibition, so we're at the beginning of no prohibition or a new regulated, you know, way to consume cannabis products. And it probably remains to be said. That's probably unanswerable at this point. We're probably going to have to wait 30, 40, or 50 years to see if there are... negative medical effects of ingesting cannabis. It seems like eating it and tinctures are much safer than anything that involves even vapor or smoking. You know, smoking seems like the worst, and vaporizing outwardly, it seems safer, right? Because you don't have the smoke factor, so you have less resins and toxins, and then, of course, going to edibles. But, of course, that's a different... You have a different experience with edibles or tinctures than you do with smoking. You know, with smoking, you kind of get that 1-2 punch. And with edibles or tinctures, it's a completely different experience.
Ooh, do you know why? There's a chemistry answer.
Ooh, goody. Yeah, tell us why.
So when you smoke cannabis, you're ingesting a form of THC called Delta 9 THC.
Delta 9 THC.
And when you eat an edible product, it converts in your liver to something called Delta 12 THC.
As long as it starts with Delta,
that's just a signifier for where the functional groups are on the molecule. So it's a similar molecule, but just different organization of the different components. And Delta 12 THC is somewhat, people have described it as psychedelic. It has different properties than Delta 9 THC. And that's why when you eat a cookie or something, it's so much different from when you're smoking.
Well, that is fascinating to learn.
Yeah.
Right? I bet a lot of listeners have been wondering why there was such a big difference.
Mm-hmm. And then...
It's all about chemistry.
Yeah.
Better living through chemistry. Right?
Sure. It also... affects the quantity that you need. So, for example, a lot of, you know, daily smokers I know will put away a gram and in one sitting, and it won't affect them too much, you know.
Don't people build up is that chemistry too? You know, the fact that, you know, if you rarely smoke versus you're a daily user, you're definitely going to have a different experience using the same exact flower.
Sure. Yeah, that's definitely true. I don't know the science behind the resistance specifically, but if you were to parse it out and figure out exactly how much, say your flower is 20% THC, which means that you're consuming 200 milligrams of THC via smoking it, and then... The same person will go and they'll eat a cookie that has, or a piece of chocolate that has 20 milligrams of THC in it, and just be high out of their mind. I think it's because the effective potency, or, you know, the effect that Delta 12 THC has on your body is just a lot more it's a lot more significant than the Delta 9. So that's another thing to keep in mind. It's when you eat, you don't need as much per se.
I've observed the effects of people, you know, ingesting too much edibles.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not always pretty. Things can happen. You know, you could fall down. I'm Robbie Yeaman with The Digital Divide, and we are talking with a former cannabis lab technician, an individual who has a master's degree in chemistry, and we are talking about laboratory testing of cannabis and where we're going in our brand new world, right? You know, I mean, I know there was a time where I thought, I don't know if it'll ever be legal. These people are crazy. You know, keeping the prohibition. I mean, to me, the prohibition and the quote unquote drug war, that just seemed like an incredibly convenient way to funnel money to other countries, you know, to either subsidize the government or to subsidize, you know, uprisings and coups or both at the same time. So, you know, I think that ending prohibition, ending the drug war, if it truly is ended, you know, is a positive sign. And that's one of the positive effects, is that, you know, hopefully money just won't be funneled.
This brings up another point that I want to talk about, though. Do you want to talk about the black market?
Yeah, let's talk about the black market.
This might go well with what we were talking about before in terms of cost. And let's talk about the black market, because I think that one thing that we're going to see as a result of the increased cannabis prices and complete decriminalization of the industry,
okay,
is a black market where, you know, black market drug dealers grow themselves because it's basically decriminalized, and then are able to undercut dispensary prices by a huge margin.
Mm-hmm. That's what you think.
You think
we'll see a competition from unlicensed growers.
I definitely think so.
Then we might have like a cannabis mafia.
I don't think the black market is going away as a result of legalization. It might even grow. I'm not really in the know. It's just a random prediction I have.
Well, yeah, that's an interesting prediction. But of course, people can grow themselves. People can grow up to 4 plants.
Right.
In their home or yard. And they are, you know, walking around Portland these days. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. Now, my guest is asked to remain anonymous. So we're not going to use any names for today's guest, but we are talking to a former lab technician who was involved in the marijuana testing or the cannabis testing early on. Master's degree in chemistry, knows what she's talking about, and has had firsthand experience with labs in and around the Portland area. So we thank you for your time and your willingness to share your knowledge and expertise with us.
Oh, sure. Anytime.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And you've been listening to The Digital Divide on KBOO Portland. Coming up next, Moving On with Don Jacobson. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. Not a current member? You can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today.
Bell, this calling, this burden, this stood. In the deep wood, ah, there I stood, a child so fair. On a sudden square, down the dirty stairs, to see the table set with golden chairs. Ah, to follow, follow, follow,
to KBOO Portland. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from True West, presenting an evening of eclectic Celtic music with Canadian multi-instrumentalist Lorena McKennett, March 23rd at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall. Tickets and information for Lorena McKennett on March 23rd are available at portland5.com. You're listening to KBOO.